The Oracle Network.
Look deeper. Well, hello there, friends, and welcome back. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson, and today's case is going to cover the second half of Danny Rowling, the Gainesville Ripper. Last week, I took you through his tumultuous upbringing, the abuse he endured from his father, James, which led to a pretty steady decline in his mental health until he could no longer control his impulses, as well as the murders of three members of the Grissom family, who Rowling was later believed to have killed. Today's episode is going to pick up with his second murder spree, where he slaughtered five college students over a four-day period in August 1990, as well as his capture, trial, sentencing, and eventually his execution on October 25th, 2006. Rowling was a terrifying human being. He showed no remorse for his victims, and at his sentencing, family, friends, and even a previous attorney testified on his behalf against receiving the death penalty because of his mental state. However, at his execution, some relatives of his victims believed he got off too easily for his crimes, especially when Rowling chose to sing a church hymn during his last moments instead of addressing the family members present. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Even with the discovery of the horrific murders inside the Grissom home, Danny Rowling wasn't even a remote consideration as a suspect, and he continued to creep under the radar. On Christmas Eve 1989, Danny and his father James got into yet another huge fight, and Danny left the house, wandering around until he, quote, came upon a house where he had watched a woman undress before and broke in. No one was home. While waiting for her to return, he watched television, listened to her stereo, and sampled her vast collection of alcohol. She never came back, so he stole about $30 worth of dimes, a fifth of Chivas Regal, and a .38 caliber revolver, end quote. 5 months later, Danny and James got into another violent argument, but this time, he shot his father twice, once in the stomach and once in the forehead. James would end up surviving, but he lost an eye and an ear in the process. Over the next 2 months, his mental health significantly continued to decline, and he committed a slew of robberies in Shreveport, including the home of recently deceased Michael Kennedy Jr., stealing two handguns as well as his identification papers on June 2, 1990. Danny also robbed a Westwood United Superstore twice in the span of 2 weeks, getting away with a combined total of $3,662. By July 22, 1990, he had hopped on a bus and was headed to Sarasota, Florida, and using the paperwork he'd stolen from Michael Kennedy, he began committing fraud by pretending to be him. He didn't stop with the robberies either. He broke into an apartment belonging to Christopher Osborne, stole his car, and drove to Tampa, committing more burglaries along the way. On August 23rd, he checked into a motel in Gainesville, Florida under Michael Kennedy's name, but ended up actually setting up a campsite in the woods, which happened to be just a short distance from the campuses of the University of Florida and the Santa Fe Community College. August 24th, 1990 would mark the start of a terrifying four-day murder spree that paralyzed the city of Gainesville and sent panicked students fleeing from the campus. That Friday, the 24th, Rowling had broke into an apartment belonging to 17-year-old Sonia Larson and 17-year-old Christina Powell. Armed with an automatic pistol and a knife, he first covered Sonia's mouth with duct tape as she struggled to fight him off. He slashed her arms and then fatally slashed her left thigh, severing her femoral artery before stabbing her to death. He then moved quietly downstairs to where Christina was sleeping, surprising her and taping her mouth shut, using more duct tape to restrain her hands. He stripped her clothes off and sexually assaulted her, forcing her to perform oral sex on him before he raped her. When he finished, he laid her face down on the floor, took the knife and plunged it into her body 5 times, killing her, before then mutilating her body. He then went back upstairs and raped Sonia's corpse before fleeing the apartment. As he was biking away from the crime scene, Rowling recalled how he allegedly began to feel ill when he found one of their nipples in his bag. I'm sorry, but what do you mean you found one of their nipples in your bag? It's not like, oops, how did this get in there kind of situation. Like, you mutilated their bodies, you cut off their nipples, and you kept one as a trophy. So why are you surprised? That sounds like a load of BS to me, if I'm being honest. The following day, Rowling broke into the apartment of 18-year-old Krista Hoyt and waited for her to return home. When she walked in the door, Rowling leapt out and surprised her, tackling her, taping her mouth and hands, before he led her into her bedroom. He removed her clothing and assaulted her before laying her face down on the bed and stabbing her in the back, piercing her aorta and killing her. When her body was found, it was, quote, propped up, sitting on her bed, bent over at the waist. Rowling had sliced off her nipples and left them on the bed next to her, and police discovered that her torso was sliced open from her chest to her pubic bone, her severed head perched on a shelf across the room, end quote. Part of this makes me wonder if he didn't put her head on the bookshelf because he wanted an audience. Did he put it there so that she could watch what he did to her after she was dead? I mean, as if murdering her wasn't enough, he felt that he needed her to watch him as he desecrated her body. I'm not sure, but that's the first thing that popped into my head when I read that description. And given what he does with the bodies, how he poses them, it wouldn't surprise me entirely, but I never really did find confirmation on that theory, so I'm just throwing it out there as something that popped into my head when I was reading this case. 2 days later, on August 27th, he broke into the apartment of 23-year-old Tracy Pauls and 23-year-old Manuel Tabuada. He snuck into the first bedroom he came across, which happened to be Manuel's, and stabbed him as he slept. The first stab punctured his thoracic vertebrae, but violently woke him up. Manuel began fighting back as hard as he could, but Rowling continued to viciously stab at him, piercing his arms, hands, legs, chest, and face until Manuel lay motionless and dead on his bed. Hearing this commotion, Tracy was alarmed and emerged from her room, creeping quietly down the hallway until she got to just outside Manuel's door. She peered through the crack and spotted Rowling, who, realizing that he was being watched, moved quickly, chasing her down the hallway to her bedroom. He broke open her locked bedroom door and bound her with duct tape. He ripped off her shirt and sexually assaulted her before flipping her over on the bed, just like he did with Christina Powell and Krista Hoyt, so she was face down, and then stabbed her 3 times in the back. Rowling then, quote, cleaned and posed the body of Tracy Pauls and left the apartment, end quote. Authorities speculate that he may have been interrupted before he was able to finish mutilating her body and had to escape to avoid being caught. By Monday, the entire city of Gainesville was on edge. College students were running from the city by the thousands, and out of everybody who left, 700 of those students never came back. The few that actually decided to remain in the city huddled together in bigger groups inside a few apartments for protection. One student, 19-year-old Stacy Green, stated, quote, "We slept with steak knives. I need to call my mom. This is unreal," end quote. Other students carried baseball bats, most slept in shifts, and no one ventured out alone. In response, Gainesville police created a multi-agency task force launching a manhunt for the killer. At first, they were surveilling a man named Edward Humphrey, who was initially thought to be the suspected killer. Meanwhile, Rowling had committed yet another robbery and barely escaped. He made it back to his campsite, which he was sharing with a man named Tony Danzy, but Danzy, upon seeing the state of Rowling and his blood-soaked clothes, threatened to call the police and report him, so Rowling fled. When police finally discovered the campsite on August 29th, they found several items that he had taken from the murder scenes, as well as a bag of money that had pink dye all over it. They knew that whoever had been camping out here was a dangerous man, and they needed to find him as soon as possible. Unfortunately, Rowling was just a couple steps ahead of the police. He had already broken into another apartment and robbed a Save and Pack in Tampa before stealing a car and driving to Ocala. By September 8th, he had made it back to Shreveport and on that same day, quote, attempted to rob a Winn-Dixie supermarket. While forcing the manager at gunpoint to empty the office safe, the store's bookkeeper had called police from a phone in the front of the store. Police arrived as he pulled out of the lot and a high-speed chase began. After crashing his car, he fled on foot to a nearby office where police arrested him, end quote. The Gainesville Ripper was finally in custody, but no one knew it yet, and the murders took over the news media all across the country. Police had no reason at this point to connect him to the murders because when he was arrested, it was just for the bungled robbery. So he was charged and pled guilty to 3 burglaries, including a couple, I believe, in Tampa. And after he ripped a toilet seat off of its mounting and had thrown it across the room, quote, his defense attorney asked for psychological tests and moved to withdraw the guilty plea on Rowling's armed robbery charges, end quote. But the judge ruled against dismissing the charges, and Rowling was convicted of all 3 burglaries and sentenced to 3 life sentences plus 170 years in October 1991. All the while this was happening, police in Shreveport were still investigating the Grissom murders when they finally got a break. They had, quote, contacted the Gainesville Police Task Force and described similarities between the murders in Florida and a triple homicide in Louisiana in November 1991, end quote. By January 1992, police in Gainesville concluded that the similarities in the sexual positioning of both the Gainesville victims and Julie Grissom, and the fact that all the victims in each location had been stabbed, pointed to the same suspect. As a result, quote, Florida investigators sought DNA of prisoners from Shreveport who were incarcerated, end quote. Because Danny Rowling had been arrested in Shreveport and was incarcerated because of the robberies, he was included in this, and the DNA left at the Gainesville murder scenes was a close enough match to Rowling that police knew they had their killer in custody. Honestly, this was kind of sheer luck. The fact that police departments in Florida and Louisiana were discussing their cases, which doesn't always happen. Also, because Rowling took active steps to remove any traces of semen, fingerprints, or other evidence from each crime scene, it's pure luck that they were able to make this connection, and thank goodness. If you remember from part 1 of this case, the body of Julie Grissom was found to have vinegar poured all over her, and this was most likely in an attempt to get rid of any physical or DNA evidence. It's probably all he could find in the house, maybe. Maybe he wanted to just use whatever was readily accessible right there instead of looking for cleaning supplies and try to get rid of any of that evidence. And at the first 2 Gainesville murder scenes, Rowling had, quote, used cleaning solvents on the dead bodies to remove any traces of semen, end quote. He also took the duct tape that he used on any of his victims with him and would toss it into a nearby dumpster. With all of this new evidence, it really began a domino effect. By June 1992, Rowling was extradited to Florida and finally charged for the murders of Sonia Larson, Christina Powell, Krista Hoyt, Tracy Pauls, and Manuel Taboada. Prior to these charges, Rowling had received another life sentence plus an additional 30 years for robbing the First Union Bank, which I'm assuming is the bag of money with the pink dye found at the campsite. After this conviction in May 1992, he attempted suicide and was sent to the psychiatric ward of Florida State Prison. Shortly before he was charged for the Gainesville murders, Rowling began corresponding with Sandra London. By the following February, 38-year-old Rowling and London announced their engagement and began writing a book together called The Making of a Serial Killer: The Real Story of the Gainesville Murders. In February 1994, Rowling pleaded guilty to all 5 murder charges during jury selection, and in the hopes of convincing the jury that her son was severely mentally ill and needed treatment rather than prison, a videotaped interview of Claudia, his mother, that was conducted by police in 1992 when her son was first linked to the murders, was played for the jury and showed her explaining the moment where she knew something was deeply wrong with her son. They were sitting at the dinner table when he confessed some of his darkest, innermost thoughts to her. She stated, quote, "He said it was another person. His voice was deeper, harsh. His face got real hard, almost no emotion there at all, just kind of a deadpan expression. If I didn't know him so well, I probably wouldn't have known it was him," end quote. She mentioned that her son had talked about another person inside him and that he had given it a name, although she was unable to recall it. Claudia described how Danny's walk, his voice, his behavior would change when this other person was present. Additionally, Lillian Mills, one of Rowling's ex-girlfriends, also testified that, quote, "She had made an appointment for him with a psychologist and told Claudia about it," end quote. Rowling refused to keep the appointment, though, telling her, quote, "If my dad finds out what I said, he'll kill me," end quote. And as if the testimony of Rowling's mother and one of his ex-girlfriends weren't enough, his former attorney, Arthur Carlyle, told the jury that when he was representing Rowling in Mississippi in 1985, remember I said there was an attorney that was going to come back into play here, this is the guy, he had called James, Rowling's father, to ask him to help his son. And instead of hearing the concerned voice of a father on the other end of the phone, Carlyle said, quote, "James Rowling shouted at him, said he didn't want his help, and that he should not be helping his son," end quote. Medical experts also established, quote, that at the times of his crimes, he had the emotional maturity of a 15-year-old and that he suffered from extreme emotional disturbance, end quote. Despite all of this, however, the multiple statements about the constant verbal and physical abuse that Danny suffered at the hands of his father, the testimony of his former attorney, medical expertise, jurors still chose to recommend the death penalty and sentenced Rowling not to one, but to 5 death sentences in March 1994. Upon learning about the conviction and sentencing of their son, James took his anger out on his wife Claudia one last time, beating her severely and kicking her out of their house. Claudia passed away at the age of 63, not long after this and after her son had been sentenced. Taking into consideration Rowling's history, it wouldn't be unheard of for someone who had experienced the kind of trauma and abuse that Rowling did as a child and well into adulthood to develop another separate personality. This personality would help to dissociate him from the pain and act as a replacement for him and take the brunt of any abuse or degradation from his father. Dissociative identity disorder is rare and can be extremely hard to diagnose accurately, but I do think it could be a possibility given Rowling's history. He was first examined in January 1991 by Gainesville clinical psychologist Harry Kropp, who had diagnosed him as having, quote, "a borderline personality characterized by violent mood swings, impulsive and self-destructive behavior, narcissism, and antisocial feelings," end quote. I'm curious if dissociative identity disorder, more commonly known probably to a lot of us as multiple personality disorder, especially back then, I'm wondering if it ever came up in Kropp's discussions when he was trying to come up with a diagnosis for Rowling. I can't imagine that his mother would make something this drastic up, you know, this other person, because it seemed like this change in her son really frightened her and she just didn't know what to do to stop it or how to help him. And at least one of his ex-girlfriends was concerned enough to try to get him to see a psychologist. His former attorney experienced the wrath of Rowling's father firsthand over the phone, so is it really that impossible that at one point, right before the first string of murders, that Rowling snapped, that this other person took over because he was no longer able to deal with the abuse from his father and this other person lashed out? I'm not sure. It could be a possibility. I don't think it's that much of an unimaginable situation. And I will present the other side to this as well, because it might not be mental illness to that extent, because in one of his confessions, he stated, quote, that he wanted to become a superstar. His tools were simple: his K-bar knife, duct tape, a handgun, and a screwdriver for break-ins, end quote. Sadly, going back to Sonia and Christina, their door was unlocked, so I'm going to take this moment and just say, please, 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 always lock your doors. I don't care where you live or how safe you think your neighborhood is, just lock your doors. And after Rowling was charged with the Gainesville murders, he also said, allegedly, that he wanted to murder one person for every year that he was locked up. So, while I think the evidence clearly points to a very mentally disturbed individual who was not capable of controlling his impulses and his emotions, I do also see him as possibly someone who just wanted to cause others pain because he was in so much pain, and not necessarily that his actions were the result of another person. So, to wrap this tangent up, basically, I do think that dissociative identity disorder could be a possibility for him. However, based on evidence of what he has stated or had stated since his arrest, I don't think it is the actual diagnosis. I do think he is mentally ill, and I do think that he needed a lot of treatment for it, but I don't think that the actions and the murders that he committed could be solely based on another person or another personality. Once Rowling had officially been sentenced to death in April 1994, he did apologize to the court for his crimes. That would be the only people that he would end up apologizing to. He never actually apologized to any of the relatives of his victims, but he did apologize to the court. And I know for me, if I was related to one of his victims, I probably wouldn't put much stock in his apology, because I don't know if he would actually feel remorse for what he had done, or if he was just sorry that he got caught. Because he sure as hell wasn't sorry when he mutilated the bodies of some of his victims. So how much can you really take his apology into consideration as actually being remorseful? After his sentencing, he would spend his time on death row finishing up his book with Sandra, releasing it in 1996, and filing appeals to overturn his conviction. In March 1997, 42-year-old Rowling had his appeal rejected by Florida's Supreme Court. He would spend the next several years on death row and eventually received his date of execution for October 25th, 2006. His time was finally up. Unlike his victims, he got to enjoy a last meal, and when asked if he had any last words, as he was restrained on the gurney, he didn't speak. He didn't mention any regret or sorrow for the lives he stole, the pain he caused, the fear he instilled, none of it. Instead, he sang. He laid there in full view of about a dozen family members of his slain victims, not caring about anyone else but himself, and sang a freaking church hymn, repeating the phrase, "None greater than thee, O Lord," as the chemicals began to flow into his veins. At 6:13 p.m. on October 25th, 52-year-old Gainesville Ripper Danny Rowling was pronounced dead from lethal injection. Many friends and family members of the victims truly believed he got off too easily. I mean, yes, he was strapped down on a gurney when the life slipped out of him, but they noted how he, quote, wasn't attacked by ambush while he slept. His victims were stabbed so hard with his U.S. Marine Corps-style K-bar knife that their chipped and slashed bones were later shown to the jury, end quote. As we come upon the 30-year anniversary of the Gainesville murders, the horror still resonates with me, as I'm sure it does with many others. I can vaguely remember hearing about Rowling on the news as a kid, years after, when they discovered that he was the one who had actually committed the murders. When this happened, I was, I believe, about 5 or 6 years old, and I remember being shocked that something like that could happen. At that age, I still believe that everybody in the world was good. And as much as I try to still maintain that, I know it's not true. And it is still hard to digest that there are people capable of that kind of evil. And again, I feel like a broken record, but it's true. There are people out there who are just so evil that I don't know if any punishment they receive could actually be called justice. We in this country suffer from what seems to be a revolving door justice system, a pathetic excuse for mental health treatment and resources. I mean, and child abuse, where does it end? I honestly don't think Danny Rowling should have walked free after his second prison escape. I feel like there had to have been red flags, warning signs, something to indicate that releasing this man back into society was a mistake. I mean, even if there was no evidence or reports of him having physically assaulted someone or harming someone, he was still dangerous. He was convicted several times of armed robbery. And I understand technically one could argue, well, police didn't know he had a violent streak like this. He had only been arrested for burglary, for armed robbery. But there were at least two rapes attributed to him. And I do understand early 1990s, late 1980s, more needed to be done back then in terms of combining the mental health and legal systems in order to prevent criminals like Rowling from being released untreated. And we've seen this again in other cases that I've covered where a soon-to-be murderer, often with a history of significant abuse, would be declared no longer a danger to society. I mean, really, at the end of the day, it's just such an unfortunate and tragic case for the victims especially, but also in some aspects for Rowling, who clearly needed psychiatric intervention and treatment, but he never got it because he was too afraid of what his father would say. And his father was a man who physically and emotionally abused his son to the point where his son spiraled out of control and reacted in the worst way possible. Okay, friends, that was the conclusion of the case of Danny Rowling, the Gainesville Ripper. I honestly didn't realize that the movie Scream was inspired by his case until I began digging deeper into this case and came across an article talking about it, but looking back, now it makes sense. In the early 1990s, screenwriter Kevin Williamson was struggling to find that million-dollar idea for a movie when he began researching Danny Rowling. After reading about the murders, how they paralyzed the city of Gainesville, and the full-blown media coverage of the manhunt, he knew he wanted to write a horror film about students being murdered by a killer and the media frenzy that comes along with it. Using Rowling's case as a guide, the Scream franchise was born. He also said that Rowling made him seriously consider writing about a serial killer on a college campus who is actually a college professor and being hunted down by an FBI agent, but the opportunity for Scream presented itself first. Now, if the serial killer, college professor, FBI agent storyline sounds even remotely familiar, it's because after the success of Scream launched his career, Williamson, also coming off yet another success of penning the scripts for other horror movies such as I Know What You Did Last Summer and The Faculty, as well as creating this other show called Dawson's Creek, maybe you've heard of it, he got the opportunity to write a TV series for Fox called The Following. It's a show about an FBI agent played by Kevin Bacon who is tracking a serial killer, and he's consulting with a college professor for help in catching him. The college professor ends up being the serial killer and played by British actor James Purfoy. It's such a good show. It has serial killers, cults, and it's disturbing as hell. So, for that reason, I'm not at all surprised that I was sucked in, but I'm not surprised either that it was canceled after only 3 seasons because apparently not everybody shares my taste for the macabre, and I'm still so bummed that it was canceled, and it's literally been like 10 years since it was canceled. Maybe not that long, but it's been a while. Either way, I highly recommend it. And if you're listening to my show, I'm guessing it's right up your alley and you'll probably like it, or you've already seen it. All right, friends. Thank you so much to everyone who has sent their killer, pun intended, suggestions to Mask of Sanity on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. For anyone who hasn't sent in a suggestion of killers you'd like to hear me cover, you can always reach me on Instagram at Mask of Sanity the Podcast and on Twitter at Masked Sanity Pod. And if you haven't done so yet, another reminder, please follow the Oracle Network on Twitter and Instagram. It's OracleNetwork. Please check out our website. It's always linked in my episode notes. We have bios, podcast players for all of our shows. You can listen to any of them. They're so good. We have so many different true crime and not true crime shows. We're not just a true crime network. And also, super exciting, I have a merch store and the link is in my episode notes as well. So if you're interested, check it out. Check out the designs. You can get anything from a t-shirt to a coffee mug to a sticker, a magnet, a pillow, or if you want a face mask, there are those too. And please stick around after the show for the promo trailer for Dos Spookeños. If you want to be creeped out by a good ghost story, this is the show for you. No joke. I listened to the Hatman episode and was either cracking up at the hosts or watching the hairs on my arm stand up because I was so creeped out by the stories they were telling. Subscribe and listen today. I promise you won't regret it. Just another reminder, my resources and Patreon link are also in the episode notes. Thank you all so, so much for listening, and please join me next week when I cover the very bizarre case of Charlie Brandt, who shot and killed his pregnant mother when he was 13, spent a year in a mental institution, and then, over 30 years later, murdered his wife and his niece before committing suicide. Come prepared. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Hi, I'm Eric Carter Lundeen, and you might know me from True Consequences Podcast.
And I'm Alex, and you may not know me at all.
And we are Dos Spookeños.
Join us weekly as we tell you all about the paranormal in New Mexico.
We will cover aliens, ghosts, and other weird happenings and phenomena.
You can find Dos Spookeños wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Stay spooky, and don't forget to rate, subscribe, and review Dos Spookeños. Look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Dos Spookeños. Peace!